William Borucki is a space scientist with NASA's Ames Research Center. He started a series of research papers and proposals and other work in 1984 that led to the launch of the Kepler Space Observatory in 2009. He's a finalist this year for a Service to America Medal in the Career Achievement category. Bill, it is terrific to have you on the program. Congratulations on this. What was the genesis of this idea? What were you thinking about leading up to the first work that you did on Kepler in 1984 that made you think this was possible? Well, thanks for coming on today.
You're most welcome. What really got me started was the fact that I was always interested in finding out, you know, the extent of life in our galaxy. Is there life out there? What is it like? And that's going to happen on a number of steps. We're not going to just immediately go and get that answer on a study of work. So in 1984, I saw a nice article. Someone talked about the possibility of using a telescope in space to, or really a telescope to try to find the dimming of a star when a planet moves in front of it. That gives you the size of the planet. You can get the orbital period, but when it repeats. And now you've got the first step. You're finding, are there Earths? What kind of planetary, what kind of stars are they around? What's their orbital period like? What's their temperature like? Could they have water on the surface? All the steps we need to know that there could be life in space. And so I got started trying to build a photometer that measures the brightness of stars so that we could actually get that answer. Are Earth frequent or rare in our galaxy? And that was the beginning of my effort to do that.
All right, so the first proposal you made for something like Kepler was 1992, was rejected. 1994, you tried again, rejected. 1996, third time, rejected. 98, number four, didn't make it. 2001, you broke through, and work began. What'd you do in 2000?
And people finally said, "Uncle."
If we give it to him this time, he'll go away. What did you do differently in 2001, or what had changed in the interim that finally helped you break through?
Actually, what helped us was each time we would send a proposal, we wrote a very excellent, very hard, very well-developed proposal, and the review panels of experts would look at it and find the places that it was weak, that it might not work. And so they would send us, they would reject the proposal, they would send us this information, and we'd have 2 years to go back and understand how do we fix the proposal, how do we build a better mission that was more likely to succeed. So each time we got rejected, we learned a great deal from the panel that told us why we were rejected, and then we basically changed. Now, the other aspect of it is they would go and say to us, well, no one had ever found a detector that would do this well. We found such a detector, we proved it worked. No one had ever done automated photometry of thousands and thousands of stars simultaneously, which is what you need to find these very rare transits of planets across stars. So we built an observatory to show that. And so many of these things they would ask us to do, we could do them, we could get money, and we showed they could all be done. And so I think they're finally satisfied that indeed the money would be worth it, the mission would fly, and we would get the data and the answers that we really sought.
Kepler launched in 2009, and I can't imagine that you are anything but just thrilled with the progress that it's made in the 4 years since then, sir.
Yes, it has been absolutely superb because we found, at this point, something in the order of 4,000 candidates, and that goes up every week, every month. We're finding more and more candidates. We've only been able to confirm something of the order of 130 or 140 of these because it takes so long once you find something that looks like a planet to prove it could be nothing other than a planet. And so we're still working on these many, and we're finding that most of these candidates that we look at seriously truly are planets. So we've got some work to do, but we're just delighted to see planets as small as that of the Earth's moon, planets bigger than Jupiter, and everything in between, around all kinds of stars. And certainly what we're finding is most stars have planets. And we have found something of the order of 280 planets about the size of the Earth. 280. We found another 650 that are a little bit bigger than the Earth. So we think among those, we're finding some of them, we'll find some planets in the habitable zone. Finding a small planet and finding a planet in the habitable zone are two different things. The longer the mission runs, the longer the orbital periods get that we can find, and we need orbital periods of the order of a year to find planets in the habitable zone, like the Earth going around the sun.
Bill Borucki of NASA's Ames Research Center, and that's where I wanted to go next, Bill, is once you identify a candidate, what's the elimination process, I guess, to determine whether it stays a candidate, whether it continues to be a candidate, or whether it's one you have to cross off the list?
There's two two aspects to that, one of which is you look at the data very, very carefully and say, you know, does it look exactly like a transit? If it's V-shaped, it's just one star crossing another star. If it's got a nice round bottom, then it might be a planet. You go to the telescopes throughout the world, the Keck telescope in Hawaii, the telescopes in Hobley-Everly telescope in Texas, and you check to see that it's not a small star crossing a big star. It's not a pair of stars in the background having their eclipsing signal mixed in with your target star. So we do a sack of things like that at the world's biggest and best telescopes to prove it can't be anything other than a planet. And sometimes we can actually measure the mass of a planet. When you measure the mass, you can say, well, I got the size from transits. I got the mass now from radial velocity. I can get the density and thus an idea of the composition. And we know some of our planets, therefore, small planets, are rocky planets. We know some of our big planets are gas planets. And we've got a question about planets that are sort of intermediate. Are they rocky or are they gas? And so we use all this information from ground-based telescopes and the Kepler system to tell us about these planets and what they might be like.
You have been at NASA for over 50 years, according to the nominating information for this Service to America medal. What is it that keeps you going? What is it that keeps you so passionate about this? Your passion's obvious just from talking to you about it, Bill.
Imagine you had a chance to work on the Apollo program. I did. That was a wonderful experience. A lot of hard work, but the point is, what an accomplishment to help people get to the moon and back. After that was pretty well over, then I went to a group where we were looking at the Earth's atmosphere and how mankind is changing it by putting pollutants in it and things like that. And so here, another example of trying to understand what we're doing to their atmosphere so we can do the right thing for our own planet. And of course now, trying to find out whether this Earth, what kind of life there might be in the universe. Boy, it's hard to quit. I could have retired 10 years ago. But I'm so excited about what we're doing. And I like so much working with groups like NASA and the people here who are excited about discovering these things. So it's hard for me to think about retiring.
Bill, it is fascinating to read about your career. Congratulations on it. Congratulations for your selection as a finalist as a Service to America Medal winner. And thank you very much for coming on the program to talk with me today. I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you, Francis. I enjoyed it.